Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And the opinions you hear here today are not those of the University of California Regents, but my opinions and my guests' opinions, and that's that. Today, my guests are Francine Prose and Andrew Weiner. First up is Francine Prose. Prose is author of 11 novels, short story collections, 3 books of translation, and a collection of novellas, 4 books for children. Her most recent novel, Blue Angel, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her stories, reviews, cultural criticism, and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, Art News, Elle, The Paris Review, and Tin House. She is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Prose is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, 2 NEA grants, 2 New York State Council of the Art grants, a Penn Translation Prize, and the Jewish Book Council Prizes, 2 Jewish Book Council Prizes. In 1989, she traveled throughout the former Yugoslavia on a Fulbright Creative Writing Fellowship. Her most recent book and first book of nonfiction is called The Lives of the Muses, and it's published by HarperCollins. Hi, Francine.
Hi, Barbara.
You are one of the busiest writers. What is your secret here?
Well, actually, you know, there are 2 things. One is I can read in the car when my husband's driving. And the other is I learned as a kid, I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, and parents shouldn't just not pay any attention, but my parents let me do my homework in front of the TV.
Uh-huh.
So
you can write anywhere.
I can write with the TV going.
Mm. But seriously, you are so prolific. I mean, I remember seeing your work in The New Yorker years and years mm-hmm. ago and have sort of followed your work since I first discovered you. And you're just everywhere, and your writing is always, at least the writing I see, is always literary. It's always high quality. It seems to be thought over. It seems that you have very carefully chosen what you're going to write about, how you're going to write about it. Unlike many writers who say need to become successful,
I like to write. I mean, as strange as that might sound coming from a writer, I actually like the feeling of putting words down, of playing with words, of moving them around, of changing a comma. I mean, all that is very pleasant to me, and I think if I had to, I would write the backs of cereal boxes.
Interesting. Tell us about The Lives of the Muses, subtitled 9 Women and the Artists They Inspired. Where did this book come from?
Well, I got a grant from the New York Public Library to spend a year in the library at the Center for Writers and Scholars and Writers. I don't know why I put writers first. It's scholars and writers. And I needed a project to spend my year there. And I was looking around for a project, and I found a letter that Dr. Samuel Johnson had written to Hester Thrale. And the letter was introduced with a little paragraph that said, for 20 years, Hester Thrale was Samuel Johnson's muse and hostess, and they had a platonic friendship, which was ended with the letter below. And it was the most irrational, intense letter. And I thought, what do you mean platonic friendship? And then I thought, what do you mean muse? So I began to look into the relationship of artist and muse and who these women were that were famous for being muses. And I decided to write essays about 9 women from different centuries who were famous for being someone's muse, and that's how the book began.
How did you choose the women?
I made a huge long list. And now, in fact, so many of the reviews say, why didn't she pick blah, blah, and why didn't she do Alma Mahler, and why didn't she... I limited to 9 for obvious reasons. There were 9 Greek muses.
Yes.
And then I had to pick and choose, and I decided I wanted women whose stories were different as possible from the others, and I wanted women from different centuries, and I wanted women who were involved with artists from different spheres, musicians, painters, poets, and so forth. So those were the basis by which I made the decisions.
Interesting. I like that you included Yoko Ono. She's received a lot of wrath.
You know, I credited my son in the acknowledgments. My younger son and I were watching I don't know, MTV or VH1 or one of those programs, and it was, you know, Behind the Music or Living Legends or one. And my son said, Yoko Ono, that's your last muse, Mom. And I said, that's right.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Yeah, this is a wonderful book, and I always like to ask authors something that may seem just so inconsequential, and that is, the cover is wonderful, too. Did you have any say over what it would be?
Yeah, I found the image. I have to say, my beloved publisher just said, use it. You know, it's a photo of Nancy Cunard and Tristan Tzara, the Dada artist, taken by Man Ray. And she's wearing these kind of flowery silk pajamas and a harlequin mask and a top hat. And he's in a tuxedo and he's bending down, kissing her hand. And it's very mysterious and sexy and funny and bizarre. And it just seemed to me that the mood of the photograph, I hoped, matched the mood of the book.
Yes.
You know,
I think
I found
it does.
You were saying about writing other things besides novels and essays. I was assigned to write a piece for Harper's Bazaar, I think, about trousers. I don't know. And there was some French book about trousers. And this is one of the photographs in the book, and I just finished The Lives of the Muses, and I looked at this photo, and I thought, bingo.
Interesting. Yeah, it is. It is wonderful. It goes with, in a way, it goes with the cover of Blue Angel.
Mm-hmm. Another black and white photograph.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any say over that one?
Yeah, we found that one. I say we. My husband actually found it. I said, I want a vintage porn photograph, and I want a sort of teacher-student configuration. And he went across the street to the bookstore, and there was one of these, you know, 1,000 nudes art books, and there it was.
Hmm. And your husband's an artist.
He's a painter.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Francine Prose, author of The Lives of the Muses, 9 Women and the Artists They Inspired. What did you learn from doing this book?
Well, I learned about the lives of these women, and I really hadn't known much. I mean, part of the reason I wrote this book was that as I began to find out about these lives, they were the kind of hidden, buried women's lives that we hear about. I mean, some of them we know about. We certainly know about Yoko Ono. We know some things about the dancer Suzanne Farrell. We know some things about Gala Dali. But, for example, Alice Little, who was Lewis Carroll's muse, who inspired Alice in Wonderland, led this incredible life after she and Lewis Carroll, you know, broke up. She was 11 and he was 31 when her mother kind of kicked him out of the house. And then she went on, and when she was 18, you know, her father was an Oxford don. When she was 18, she recreated the same relationship she'd had with Lewis Carroll with the art critic John Ruskin, he was in his late 50s or 60s. And they had this sort of conspiratorial, intense, sort of romantic relationship. And then she had a love affair with Queen Victoria's son, and she married this kind of beefy British minor aristocrat. And then when she was 80, and this is where the book begins, actually, when she was 80, she was invited to New York by Columbia University to mark the 100th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's birth, and she was given a PhD for having been Lewis Carroll's muse, an honorary doctorate. So each one of these lives, as I began to find out about them, I realized that there were these rich, complicated, interesting, dramatic, romantic lives that I knew almost nothing about.
Interesting. Did you start the project thinking that you knew all that you needed to know to do the book, or do you start books? And I know most of your work is fiction, but do you start books not knowing the answer, not knowing what you're going to find?
I started the book knowing nothing about anything, which is sort of how I start my novels. I did the essays first. I did all 9 of the lives first, and then I went back and tried to figure out what I could make of all this, what they had in common, what now I thought being a muse was about, how I could put it all together. And then I wrote the introduction, and then I wrote the afterword.
Interesting. Now, because most of your work is fiction, and you do, I know that you write a lot of shorter pieces, reviews and criticism and essays and such, why did you want to do a long work of nonfiction?
Well, it was partly the library. I mean, I wanted to be able to take advantage of the library's collections.
Uh-huh.
But also, I just wanted that kind of way of doing a narrative. I mean, in a way, it's like fiction because what they have in common is their narrative. I was telling stories. Each one of these lives is a very rich, complicated story. And I was looking for a way to tell the story dramatically, the stories dramatically, and, you know, have some sort of grabby incident to start with, as if I were starting a novel, you know, mm-hmm. something to get the reader's attention. And also because I knew I was doing 9 of them, I wasn't going to be able to do that sort of, you know, history of the great-great-grandparents that you would do if you were doing a formal biography.
Yes. Interesting. What is the difference, then, between doing a longer work like this and working on shorter pieces? I mean, is it more enjoyable, or do you prefer the shorter pieces?
This was so much fun. I had such a good time to do it. And, you know, and also I was making it up as I went. You know, even though the stories were there, the lives were there, in a certain way, I could make it up as I went along. For example, you know, I'd done a lot of literary criticism, and I'd done a lot of art criticism, and here I felt that I could just pull it all together. I mean, you know, being able to write about Lewis Carroll's amazing photograph of Alice Liddell as the beggar child was writing art criticism, basically, but using it in this way to look at their relationship by looking at the photograph.
Yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Francine Prose, author of The Lives of the Muses, 9 Women and the Artists They Inspired, published by HarperCollins. What about, then, the difference between fiction and nonfiction? Do you prefer one over the other? Do they take up very different parts of your mind and your brain, your soul, yourself?
Well, they both have their pleasures. You know, one of the great things about writing this book, nonfiction, is that I never thought for a minute that I couldn't finish it. You know, when I'm writing a novel, I never know. I have so many unfinished novels sitting around. I mean, I get to a certain point and I go, this isn't going anywhere. I don't know how this is going to end. I don't know what's going to happen to the characters. These lives had already been lived. All I had to do was tell their stories. On the other hand, the sort of downside was the same thing. That is, I didn't get the kinds of surprises that I would get writing a novel. You know, writing a novel, a character can suddenly go off in another direction and say something you're not expecting. That was not going to happen with Yoko Ono or Galad Ali or, Lee Miller. These lives had already been lived. But the surprises actually came to me from their lives and from what I was finding out.
Hmm. So when you work on fiction, are you? It doesn't sound like you do any extensive sort of plotting or outlining.
I wish I did. And I wouldn't recommend working the way I work to anyone else, because you do wind up with a lot of unfinished novels. You know, I envy writers who have outlines and note cards and know the end before they start and so forth. I'm just not that kind of writer.
What do you do with those unfinished novels?
Are well, they you know, in your closet? Angel, Angela, my, I don't know, heroine, anti-heroine, is writing a novel in the novel. And the novel she's writing was an unfinished novel I put away because it seemed to me sort of juvenile, really, and it was a perfect novel for a college student to be writing. It sounded like a college student was writing it.
Hmm. So, do you ever think you're going to go back to these things?
Sometimes I do. Mostly I forget what they were.
Well, what do you think it is that takes you through, that keeps you with the ones that you've stayed with? Because you have published 11?
Yeah. Well, what you hope for, what I hope for, is that at a certain point, the thing takes on a life of its own. It just starts working, and you know who these characters are, and you know what's going to happen. The ones that I don't finish are the ones that I feel that I'm just kind of forcing every day and sort of pushing along, and they're not taking on that kind of life.
Mm-hmm. So if they don't come alive in a certain way, it's like, what's the point?
It's over, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Might you get, say, halfway through one and put it down?
Yeah, or further.
Really?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's enviable that you feel that you can put it down and start over. Start with something else.
Well,
instead of feeling like you must finish it because you came so far.
It's not exactly a choice. You know, there's just nothing you can do. You just, you know, and it's terrible. It's terrible. You put in all this time, and it's just, it's a kind of grief. But the alternative is what, to publish it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you can't stand to reread it, what makes you think someone else might want to read it?
So how do you know when it's working? Is it working when you're just constantly interested in what's happening next? Do you ever go through boring parts?
Yeah. At least I know, I just have some sense that there's something still in it for me, some spark that I can't... Well, actually, you know, when I can't put it down, when I can't get away from it, when something keeps calling me back every day.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We've been here with Francine Prose, author of The Lives of the Muses, Nine Women and the Artists They Inspired. Getting back to your book, now, was this heavily outlined? Did you know, while you were surprised by various parts of it, did you know pretty much what was going to happen, how it was going to happen, where these different women were going to fall within the context of the book and the material?
No, I mean, the strange thing was I wrote it the same way I'd write a novel. I wrote one, and then I thought, what kind of story do I want to tell now? And then I would choose another. Or I would think, what kind of story haven't I told yet? I mean, for example, I wanted a muse who was a full collaborator with her artist. I wanted a muse who really enabled the artist's work in such a way that he couldn't have done it without her. So then I found Suzanne Farrell and George Balanchine.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like a very particular case because of what she could do as a dancer, of what she was physically capable of, he was able to choreograph things for her that he'd never been able to do for any of the other dancers. And of course, you know, they were mad in love and they had this complicated relationship and she got married and left the company. You know, and then I wanted to make sure that all of them would be good stories. So if they weren't dramatic enough, I thought, well, I'll do somebody else.
You've been known to write some controversial nonfiction. Now, that is a wonderful thing, and I wonder if when you have written these different pieces that have been called controversial, if you planned on that happening, or were you surprised?
It's always a surprise, Barbara. I mean, because I realize this is going to sound naive, but some part of you always thinks with everything you write, I'm going to be understood perfectly. Everyone is going to know exactly what I mean. And they're going to say, oh, thank God someone said this. I've been wanting to say this myself. I'm so glad. And I'm just shocked when people say, how can she say this? Or, you know, I wish you hadn't said this.
How does that affect you?
It's upsetting. You know, on the one hand, I think, well, I'm glad I did it. You know, I'm just glad I did it. But I was invited, for example, to university, which will remain nameless, to talk. And when I got there, it was this sort of booby trap situation, and people had read a couple of my articles and really hated them, and they just kind of insulted me for 2 solid days, and I was weeping in the airport on my way home. I mean, it was, you know, and I kept thinking, well, it's strange, too, and I think it also has to do with being female. I kept thinking, you know, none of my male friends would be sitting in the airport lounge crying. But there I was.
Mm-hmm. Likewise, how do reviews affect you? Do you read your reviews? Are you affected by each and every one? Or do you just say, I'm just not going to read them unless somebody tells me there's a wonderful review out there?
You hear writers say that. You hear writers say, I don't read my reviews. I just don't believe it. I want to see everything. The good ones really make me happy. The bad ones... I don't know. With this book, it's been quite different because, knock on wood, the bad ones haven't been very bad. I mean, they've had quibbles, but the reviews have been mainly very supportive and comprehending, and that's a great relief.
Mm-hmm. I always seem to ask authors that come on the show this question, and that is, when you're writing, whether it's your fiction, criticism, nonfiction, other types of nonfiction, are you at all aware of the marketplace or who your audience is while you're writing, or does that come later?
Well, I think if I thought about the marketplace, I'd just kill myself right off the bat and I wouldn't ever write another. But in terms of audience, I'm very aware of audience, only in that I feel like I'm writing for people on airplanes. I mean, I don't like to fly particularly, so I'm writing for people on airplanes, people in doctors' waiting room, people at the dentist, you know, people who really need involvement and distraction. And for all those reasons may have a short attention span. I myself have kind of a short attention span, so I'm writing for someone who's even more easily bored and distracted than I am.
Mm.
So, you know, there's that compulsion I feel to keep it interesting and lively and moving along, because it's the horror of boring the reader.
Yes. So how do you see your fiction then? Do you see it as exploring ideas? Do you see it as entertainment? Do you want to change people's lives? What do you hope happens? How do you hope to affect the reader?
I just am telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just purely what I'm... And if something comes out of it, that's fine with me. And if someone's mind is changed, that's okay too. But that's not why I'm doing it. You know, I never start with an idea. I always say I don't have any ideas. I start with a plot or a bit of character or something I've observed or mm-hmm. something I've heard.
Hmm. So you start with something you've heard or something, someone you've seen on the street or
mm-hmm.
a companion. And you're
in the same way with the muses. I started with these actual lives, with these actual stories of these women that I wanted to tell. And then, as I said, you know, later I began to think about what is this all adding up to?
Mm. So is your most favorite work, since you do so many different things, is your most favorite work whatever you're working on currently, or is there something that you've done that you always want to get back to, whether it's the short story or a novella or a novel?
I love writing novels, and I really liked writing this book. And usually it is what I'm working on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite form? Is it the novel?
The novel's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it keeps you busy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I used to like, I haven't written short stories in a long time, and I liked it because you'd spend, you know, 3 weeks and you get that kind of buzz of having finished it, and it's satisfying. But the novel, you know what you're doing every day for week after week, year after year.
Yeah.
I mean, it is scary, you know, as I said, because of the fear of not finishing, and also because no one sees it for such a long time, you think, this could be unintelligible gibberish that I'm writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's one thing you don't do, is write gibberish.
Well, thank you.
at least it doesn't get published. We are at the end of our time, amazingly, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening who are trying to be a little more prolific, perhaps, or trying to do a little more work that's closer to their heart.
I don't, you know, my advice for writers always has to do with reading. Just read constantly and read the best things you can possibly read and go back and reread, I don't know, big Victorian novels. I was just reissuing one of Virginia Woolf's essays as a separate volume. It's called On Being Ill. And one of the things I said in the review was if I were teaching freshman composition again, I'd get my students to read the first sentence, which is like a page and a half, this beautiful complex sentence, over and over and over aloud to themselves, just to get a feel for the clarity, the beauty, the rhythm of a complex sentence.
Yes. Interesting. Francine, thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
coming
too.
On the show. And best of luck, continued luck with this book.
Thank you.
That is Francine Prose, author of The Lives of the Muses, 9 Women and the Artist They Inspired, published by HarperCollins. I'll get it right one of these days. Next up is Andrew Weiner. We're going to take a short break, and I want to tell you about a couple of ticket giveaways before we take that break. Eric Burden and the Animals, Friday, this coming Friday, actually, at the Coach House, and Ray Charles at the Grove of Anaheim, Friday the 4th of October. If you're interested in those tickets, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. The first emails that come in will be the winners. And please stay tuned. We'll be back with Andrew Weiner in just a minute. And welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my next guest is Andrew Weiner. He's here in the studio. Andrew Weiner was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. He nearly completed a degree in computer engineering at UCLA before entering that university's highly esteemed art school and earning a BA in fine arts. He went on to earn an MFA in painting at CalArts and study at Skowhegan Art School in Maine before heading for New York to make paintings and apprentice with artist Ross Bleckner. Ander has had solo exhibitions of his paintings on both coasts. In 1996, he was accepted into the University of California, Irvine's MFA program in fiction. And during his time there, he wrote the book that would become The Color Midnight Made and co-wrote an original screenplay titled Honky that sold to New Regency and Fox. And he currently lives here in Southern California, and he's right here. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. You know, what a tangential kind of way to find your way to writing, going from computer engineering to painting to writing. How? Tell me about that.
My Zen master tells me I suffer from confusion. What happened was I've been a painter my whole life, and after graduating CalArts, I did what most people do when they graduate from that school. They go to New York to be an art star, and I happened to arrive in New York just as the stock market was crashing in 89 and the art world fell apart. And I had one show there, but otherwise really didn't show my paintings a lot and wasn't making a lot of money and kind of started to suffer from depression. And as a way, I couldn't afford a therapist, so instead I started renting film videos. And I started watching three films a night and basically educated myself in the history of cinema over a 2 to 3 year period and became addicted to narrative. And that's when I decided, well, I'd like to try to write a screenplay myself since I had basically seen every film on the planet. And that kind of took me to Los Angeles. I had some success and I did the Hollywood shuffle for about a year and realized I was still an artist. So if I was going to write, I better either become a poet or write fiction. And that's what I started to do. And I applied to the Irvine program because I didn't really know any writers and I kind of felt isolated.
So you had some success with the screenplay, the form of the screenplay, and yet you had to get away from it.
Yeah, I mean, it's what happens when you sell a screenplay is that your agent tells you you have to go out and you're hot for about 15 minutes and you have to go pitch and all your other ideas and try to sell more. And you feel more like a used car salesman than you do a writer. It's or an actor. You feel more like an actor in a way, and which wasn't right for me. And so I really needed to. The other thing is that you get rewritten, and I had that experience where you sell a screenplay, and then they bring in three other writers to rewrite it.
It's not yours anymore.
Yeah, and it still may not get made. You know, so and all these other names get tagged onto yours. And
yeah.
So I liked the idea of having total authority over over your work.
So then when did you decide to try the MFA program? Well, and how did that all come about then?
It was, you know, it was quite naively. I'd heard, I loved Richard Ford's work and Michael Chabon's, and also I'd read Whitney Otto's wonderful novel, How to Make an American Quilt. And I noticed they all went to the Irvine program. I didn't know anything about the Irvine program. I had no idea that it was difficult to get into. And I basically had written only about 5 short stories up until that point. I took the 3 best and I sent them on down to Irvine. I got a call from Jeffrey Wolf, who was the head of the head of the program. He said, in his kind of East Coast accent, "Andrew, we love your work, but you have no letters of recommendation from any writers."
Who were your letters from?
I could only muster up 2 letters of recommendation. We were supposed to have 3, and they were both from artists. I knew artists. That's all I knew. And so he says, can you scrounge up some letters of recommendation for some writers? I said, "Jeffrey, I don't know any writers. That's why I applied to Irvine." And so he said, "Listen, you're up in L.A. Why don't you drive on down here tomorrow morning and I'm going to interview you." You know, and his concern was, if you're going to be in a master's program of writing, that you have a decent background in literature and that you're able to teach and things like that. So I went down there and I was incredibly nervous and I arrived 2 hours early and I sat around. I was reading a book and I walked into the interview with that book and Jeffrey took a look at it and kind of in his very understated way, he said, "Nice book." And what I later learned was that was the moment right then he already knew I was in.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. The book was just obscure and literary enough that he could tell I was going to be okay in this program.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. And then you found out really what you were getting into.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, I mean, it was, you know, the program only lets in six people a year. And I found out how lucky I was to be surrounded by so many talented people. And it was a great place to begin a novel.
So then the Color Midnight Made started in
it
the
did.
Program?
It really did. I had two ideas for a novel. One was a kind of a coming of age young man goes to New York to be an artist. Mm-hmm. And one was, I had written the short story about this boy and his voice really kind of jumped off the page. And I came across something Mark Twain said. He basically said in order to write an adult novel from a child's circumscribed point of view, you really have to be older. It's, in fact, a very challenging thing to do. And I thought, oh, heck, I'm going to go after the more challenging thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And that was the choice I made to begin this novel narrated by a 10-year-old boy. And I started that as I entered the program.
Will you read to us?
I will.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Andrew Weiner, author of The Color Midnight Made, and he's going to read.
Before I begin, let me just explain that The Color Midnight Made is narrated by a 10-year-old white boy who lives in a very strong African-American community in the Bay Area. At the beginning of the book, he finds out he's colorblind, which is a source of shame for him because it kind of further differentiates him in a world that's already shot through with difference. One of the characters who becomes very important to Conrad is named Midnight, and when Midnight was young, he tried to darken down a street by shooting out the lampposts, and he blinded himself in a gun accident. In this scene, Midnight is older, he's around 20, he's blind, and he and Conrad are kind of listening to the television. He's just shared a secret with Conrad, and he's about to share another one. And the only other thing you need to know is that Midnight has a baby brother named Termite, who is so named because he was born looking like a termite. I want to share something else with you, Midnight said, another secret. I knew he was going to tell me he was in love with Sandra, and I was glad he was sharing it with me. What is it? I said. A color. I skipped a breath. Before I could say anything, Midnight said, I never told anybody about it, but it's something I've been thinking about a long time. See, before I became blind, all I wanted to see was black. But when the accident happened, and black was all I could see, the world got real empty, real quick, started scaring me, actually, and I started feeling sorry for myself, too. I realized I had to fill my world with color again, because nobody else was going to do it for me. I just had to cold color it, and that's exactly what I started doing. I was able to color anything I thought of, cars, trees, animals, people. Then I started coloring my feelings. I came up with colors for when I was lonely, sad, mad, you name it, I colored it. I kept that up for a while, until one night, I was sitting right here in this same chair, holding baby Termite. He was sleeping in my arms, see, and I was just listening to his breathing. That's when I tried to color his breath. Midnight slapped his knees. Well, man, I'm telling you, I came up with something I'd never imagined. What? I asked. I was so excited I couldn't breathe. A color no one's ever seen. I'm talking about a color that's impossible to describe because it's never existed in the real world. Where is it, then? In my mind, I guess. Now I was all mixed up. Then what does it look like? Midnight took a deep breath and let it out slow, like the brightest light you've ever seen. The sun? Yeah, only take that and darken it. Soften it a little until it can flow into your eyes without leaving those echoes of light that always mess your eyes up after you look at the sun. I tried to imagine what Midnight was saying. Then he continued, pour that into the clearest water you've ever seen, so it dances and glows, so it hovers. Know what I'm saying? I think so. Imagine that water now with the color swirling through it. Imagine pouring that water into your mouth. The color's in my mouth? Exactly. See, I knew you were the person to share this with. It's in your mouth, and the color is warm and sweet. It doesn't taste like water. It's better than that. It's got honey in it, and when you swallow the color, you feel it flowing all down through your body, and it makes your skin all tingly, like when someone takes their fingertips and barely touches the skin on your back. A shiver went down my back just imagining it. Not only could I see the color Midnight was describing, I could feel it. I could even smell it. Midnight had me tasting that color. This color, he said, running his fingers over his thighs, then up his belly and chest. It goes straight down to your toes, then up the insides of your legs and through your body, filling your heart and making you see. He sat there, his chest breathing in and out. Anyway, I had to tell someone about it. I didn't know where it came from. I probably made it myself. I was staring at his black sunglasses. Night, I said. Yep. Can I see your eyes?
Midnight let out a wide smile. Then he reached up and removed the sunglasses. I got out of my seat and set down my pack, and I bent over him so that my face was right up to his. His eyes wandered side to side, and they were glassy and dark, but light at the same time. I looked into them and realized they were reflecting light straight back out. I'd never seen eyes do that. Then for a split second, I saw a flicker deep inside them, but just as fast, it was gone. I thought it was the television at first. Then it came again, a quick flash, and that was it. I didn't see it again, but it was enough. My whole body was shivering. I'd just seen the color of midnight made.
Thank you very much. It's beautiful. That was Andrew Weiner reading from The Color Midnight Made. What made you choose a character who is colorblind?
But that part is autobiographical. I was diagnosed when I was 5. That's part of it. The other part is that the colorblindness kind of functions as, in a figurative way, as Conrad's inability to see himself. At the beginning of the book, he says, he's kind of defensive. He says, I can see colors in people. You know, he may not be able to see normal colors, but he can see colors in people. And he has a particular color for everybody he knows. And this is something that I've since discovered after writing the book, that, that actually occurs among people, that they have colors for people. But in any case, he has a color for everybody he knows except for himself. And in a sense, this book is his journey to self-discovery, to finding out what his color actually is.
Interesting. Gee, that was a powerful section that you read. I wanted to ask you about the voice, and I know you said that you had started with a few stories before you came to the MFA program here.
But voice, you know, that voice that carries through the book, do you find that that voice is singular as a voice for this book and was a voice in that story but none other?
Yeah, that's a good... I like that question. No one's asked me that yet.
Oh, good.
The reason I like that question is because, yes, I mean, I spent... at the beginning of the book, I chose a 10-year-old boy in an urban environment because 10-year-old children at that age, they're still very creative linguistically, especially in urban environments. When I was young, we were constantly inventing new language. Every day, we tried to come up with new words. And in a sense, we were kind of crack linguists or poets. And your ability to kind of wield language with panache was how you defined yourself, really. What was the question again? Now I've gotten
voice.
Off track. The voice, yeah. And so one of my goals was to kind of invent a new language for this boy. And in fact, I had a whole manual of words that Conrad says. And the words, his vocabulary is kind of an admixture of actual language today, but also words that I made up because I wanted the book to kind of seem timeless. And in that sense, I'm a huge Walt Whitman fan, so I kind of wanted to have this inventive language. In that sense, then, this voice is not one that will carry over to my other novels because it really is that kind of lens of a 10-year-old looking at the world through wide open eyes, kind of unjaded, uncynical eyes, much in the way that Huck Finn did, for example.
How did you get back to that time? Have you kept journals, and did you look at journals you kept, or how did you really place yourself in that time?
It's so interesting. Maybe I never, my fiance
never
says
left.
I've never left it. Yeah, arrested development.
Which is a good thing in this case.
Yeah. I don't know how it happens with writers, but once you come up with the voice, it's as if you're there. I mean, I feel like I've lived in this 10-year-old's voice for the last 5 years. And, once I developed, perfected it, and it took about 6 months to really get the voice, down right. And once I had that, I could go away for several months and come back and turn on my computer and I'd be right back in it. And so, it just became this other voice in my life. I did hang out a little bit with 10-year-olds, but really that wasn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. So that voice isn't leaking into other fiction you're writing?
Not at all.
It just stays out.
No, it's this particular novel. I mean, like Henry James said, you have, for every particular novel, you have to find the right voice in the right form. You know, it's almost like problem solving. My second novel is kind of an epic novel that spans from World War II until now, And it's very much of a kind of a sophisticated adult narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Andrew Weiner, author of The Color Midnight Made, published by Washington Square Press. Andrew's going to be with us at the Writers Conference here next Saturday, the 5th, UCI ASJA. So you should be here because he will be here too with his books and signing and talking and all sorts of things. The process of creating this novel, did you have it thought out? I mean, you had your story. Once you had the story, are you the kind of writer that needs to do extensive outlining and plotting and figure out how everything's going to work before you start writing?
I am now, but I wasn't with this book. It was really an interesting kind of learning process. I began the book thinking, yeah, I'm going to write this great American novel, very almost naively, and in a way I'm thankful for that because it was a very organic process. Like I said, I came up with the voice, and I decided that it was going to be a story of a boy whose family is falling apart and who kind of then has to reach outside of his home and find a new family for himself, and in this case, in the Black community. And so, in a way, I started writing kind of scenes and moments, almost more like it was a process of accumulation, really. And then, kind of halfway through it, I realized, okay, I need to figure out what the story is. And then I went back and kind of did the outlining and whatnot and kind of reshaped things. A funny thing happened in the middle of composing the novel, which is I became a huge Charles Dickens fan. And the effect of which was that a 200-page manuscript ballooned out into 700 pages of Dickensian plot.
This book.
And when I handed, this was my thesis in the Irvine program, when I handed it in to Jeffrey Wolfe, he called me to dinner, which I knew right away something was up. But he said, listen, I know that Conrad Clay, you have a wonderful character here. He's going to see the light of day. He will get published, but you must listen to me. You have to cut 300, no less than 350 pages, because no one, and he, you know, what he said was that no one's going to read 700 pages of a boy unless he grows up, unless he, you know, and in my case, I knew it was very clear that this was a story of 1 year in the life of this boy. So it could not possibly be this kind of mini subplot, plots and all these things. So I went out to my car. I cried. I actually cried for several days. I was angry at Jeffrey. But finally, I realized he was right. And I took a vacation and I came back and I had to ask myself, what was the heart of this story? And really, it became almost fun. It was like cutting off a third arm on a statue, on a Greek statue. Chiseling it down to the heart of the story, and it worked, because as soon as I did that, that was the form. I sent it out and I got an agent and I sold it within a few weeks. So
in terms of cutting it then, did you cut whole sections, whole chapters? Did you whittle away lines? How did you?
It was getting rid of unnecessary subplots, really. I mean, this was a story told by the boy himself and basically about his environment, his family, and his experiences in the Black community and kind of his journey to selfhood. Anything that didn't fit directly into that, I just cut. And there were kind of a lot of, like I say, I mean, I tried to have multiple kind of characters, but still all told from his point of view. Bleak House, reading Bleak House and novels like that really kind of, while I loved them, they really weren't appropriate for this novel. So I should have been sticking to, Catcher in the Rye and some of the Irish novels.
But maybe it's
novels.
Good that you didn't.
Yeah, maybe it is. I mean, it's going to help my next novel.
Well, plus, your voice then can't be said to be, or hasn't become derivative of
right.
Catcher in the Rye, which, you know,
that's
another
right.
coming-of-age novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Good point.
So, but now you think outlining and plotting and all that is the way to go.
You know, to be honest, I still don't. I still feel that, well, my next book, because it's kind of epic and it spans three generations, I do need to do more planning, really just to save myself a lot of work. So when I say planning, having a basic idea of story, But within that, it's still, I believe, an exploratory process, because the real gems still come often unexpectedly, and I still want, it's like having a laboratory where you want good things to happen, mm-hmm. and so I still want good things to happen. And you can't plan, I mean, I'm not writing,
you can't plan it.
Yeah, I'm not writing a kind of a genre novel where there's a formula or a screenplay.
Mm-hmm. Where it's so tightly structured and things have to happen on certain pages.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We have a few minutes left. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Andrew Weiner, author of The Color Midnight Made. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We have a few minutes here. What for you is perhaps, well, I don't know if I should say the most important, but what are some important things that came out of writing this novel for you?
That's an interesting question. I guess one is kind of inventing yourself as a novelist. You know, I had been an artist my entire life, and I really kind of, you just kind of decide, well, I'm going to write a novel, and you don't know if it's going to work out. And I think all the work that I did do and the struggle and it took 5 years really, that was something that was a nice process in retrospect to go through, because you learn so much about whether you're going to be able to be a novelist at all. But, so that's one thing, is kind of mm-hmm. your creating your identity as a writer. The other thing was that I feel like I got this character into the world that never existed before, and that, the book came out in July, and I've been on tour, and I've just heard a lot. So many people have written to me and just fallen in love with this guy, and that's this character, Conrad Clay, and that's been a wonderful feeling. It wasn't really, even though it is about a kind of a dysfunctional family, it's not necessarily mine. And one of the struggles I had with this book was kind of convincing my mother that it wasn't, it wasn't that.
That she's not in it.
Yeah, that she's not in it. Yeah.
Were you worried about that in writing it?
I was a little bit, because inevitably things from your experience find their way into your work. And so your mother, my mother actually took me aside and said, listen, this woman, she takes Actifeds, she drinks Pepsi, she smokes, this and that. She thought it was her, but you just have to say it's fiction, Mom. The memoir will come later.
Many years from now.
Right.
So MFA programs, good things?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel very...
It was good for you.
It was good for me. I mean, I feel very privileged to have been a part of that program, and especially during the time that I was part of the program. I mean, in the last 2 years, we've gotten 8 novels published. Mm-hmm. It's just been insane. I mean, all my peers, basically. But more than that, really, it was the talent, being surrounded by that kind of talent.
Sure.
And Jeffrey and Michelle Latulet, who run the program, have just been amazing. So, it's 2 years or 3 years for you to kind of believe that you're a writer and not worry about anything else and be in a supportive environment. So I highly recommend it.
Any advice for the writers out there listening who are struggling and trying to finish something?
My advice is, I've been asked this question quite a bit on the road, and my answer is to remember why you started in the first place. Remember the books that you just completely fell in love with and that you go back and continue to reread, and kind of go back to that place of the passion that you have for those wonderful books. That's my best advice, really, and to not give up.
Any questions that no one ever asks you that you want to answer?
Here's the funny one. My character, Conrad Clay, drinks a tremendous amount of Pepsi Cola, and nobody's ever asked me if I also drink so much. I mean, he drinks 64 ounce Pepsi. During the composition of this book, I was drinking 134 ounces of Pepsi a day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, but I just want the
reader. You drink coffee too?
No. But I want the readers out there to know that I've since quit. I'm over it.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Andrew Weiner, author of The Color Midnight Made. He will be with us next Saturday here at the UCI ASJA conference and on a panel talking about fiction. If you want to know more about that conference, you could go to ASJA.org and follow the link on the right side of the screen to take your writing to the next level, or take your writing career to the next level, one or the other. Next Saturday the 5th is when we're doing it here at UCI. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Susan Sontag, who said, "The writer is either a practicing recluse or a delinquent, guilt-ridden one, or both, usually both." You're listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Stay tuned for the Pulaski Skyway with Mike, and stay safe.